You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 477 of the Columbia Calling podcast. This week's very special guest is Oliver Ford. He is a program officer, coordinator at the Halo Trust here in Colombia. The Halo Trust, of course, working to rid many countries of the scourge of landmines. But I'll leave it to him to explain further on. It's been a long time since we've had the Halo Trust on the podcast, and it's time to, you know, it's always time to revisit these things. And we have a fantastic conversation that even includes Ukraine and beyond. So therefore, very current, very topical. Thank you to everyone who's continuing to listen through these summer holidays. We're having the obvious summer holiday dip as you dip in listeners, as you obviously go off on holidays, spending more time in the pool, by the beach, hiking with your children, of course. You know, no more commutes at the moment, so I'm not expecting the figures to be massive, but at the same time, I'm very grateful that they continue to, well, haul in a very decent number of listeners. Last week's episode with Paola Forero has been very successful in its way when we talk about bean to bar chocolate, sustainable chocolate management, cacao in Colombia. And there have even been a couple of people writing in who work in this industry who want to be included. So that's excellent too. Putting people in contact, putting people in touch, and ensuring that, you know, these things will hopefully be a success in the future. So that's my intro for this week. Of course, please check out the Latin News podcast. I am the host of that one over for the Latin News newspaper. So just look up the Latin News podcast .com, and you can find all the links to the podcast there. We're on YouTube as well, as is the Columbia Calling podcast on YouTube. Not a lot of traction there. I don't imagine you want to see my ugly mug every week, but there it is all the same. And of course, if you want to help us, that's www.patreon.com/Columbia Calling. And, you know, it's like a little, it's a tip at the end of the month. And we are immensely grateful, both Emily and I, for these this input from you listeners and supporters out there. So we'll go over now to Emily Hart with the news, and then we'll be back with Ollie Ford discussing the Halo Trust, their work in Colombia and around the world. Thank you again, and don't go away. The Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Columbia Calling website, that's www.columbiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your top stories for the week of July 10th, 2023. Talks are set to resume between the Colombian government and FARC dissident group, the Estado Mayor Central, commanded by Iván Mordisco. Ceasefire protocols and oversight are to be discussed in coming weeks. Meanwhile, numerous outlets have reported that Iván Márquez, leader of the FARC dissident group Segunda Marquetalia, is dead, having died of injuries sustained in an attack in Venezuela last year. However, the defense minister has said that the government is unable to confirm that news. And the bilateral ceasefire between Colombia's armed forces and the Ejército de Liberación Nacional, ELN, guerrilla started this week, halting offensive action prior to a full implementation in August of a ceasefire currently agreed for 6 months. However, in the same week, the group reportedly kidnapped and then released a military sergeant and her two children, aged 6 and 8. Ghislaine Karina Ramirez was kidnapped with her children while travelling in the department of Arauca on the border with Venezuela. The ELN have not made public comment. Kidnappings have, however, spiked in recent months, with police recording more than 150 between January and May. In the whole of last year, there were 203. Meanwhile, Special Justice Tribunal, the JEP, has charged 10 former mid-level commanders of the FARC guerrilla with war crimes as part of Case 1 of the tribunal's remit. The men were charged with hostage-taking, homicide, slavery, sexual violence and torture, among other crimes. They have 30 days to accept responsibility, not facing prison, but instead restorative sentences of between 5 and 8 years, or they can deny charges, in which case they are passed to a different court, where they face up to 20 years in prison. The case is one of the JEP's most high-profile, having documented 3 decades of kidnapping, which is considered among the FARC's emblematic crimes, with more than 20,000 victims. While the truce agreed with Buenaventura's main gangs, Los Xotas and Los Espartanos, did lead to an end to violent deaths at the end of last year, the number of violent murders has spiked again in recent months, with new armed actors taking control of the city and some reported presence of the Jalisco Nueva Generación Mexican cartel. In response to the new wave of violence, the government has announced an emergency security council and renewed peace talks, though local government is calling for increased military presence in the city. The Odebrecht case, one of the largest corruption cases in Latin American history, continues to echo through Colombia. Oscar Iván Zuluaga, a founding member of the hard-right Centro Democrático Party, was seemingly heard on audio recordings admitting that his 2014 presidential campaign knowingly received more than $1 million from corrupt Brazilian multinational Odebrecht. The audios were revealed this week by Semana magazine. Zuluaga, who was finance minister to former President Álvaro Uribe and ran for president in last year's elections, has now resigned and been charged by the prosecutor's office. His son, who was campaign manager, was also charged, though both have denied charges. Those were your top stories for this week. Thanks for listening.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling, episode 477. Hard to believe. I'm sitting here in Bogota, Colombia, and my very special guest is across town, also in Bogota, Colombia, but you know how it is. I'm speaking to Ollie Ford. He is the program manager of the Halo Trust in Colombia. Amazing outfit, obviously, all involved in the humanitarian demining, that's landmines, demining here in Colombia, but I know he travels all over. We haven't had anyone on from the Halo Trust since, I think it was 2019, when the former guy in charge was Ash Boddy, an Australian. Things have moved on significantly since then, but Ollie is here talking to us. He's going to give us an overview of, the situation in the world, and then we'll talk about Colombia. So, Ollie, welcome on the Colombia Calling podcast.
Thank you very much, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
Yeah, well, it's your first time. Yeah, but you set us up with Ash Boddy, the guy. Where's he moved on to now?
Ash is now back in Australia. So he's with his family in Australia. He left the Halo Trust a few years ago, but he did an excellent job whilst he was here. And yeah, as you said, things have moved on quite considerably since then. And we're living in different times in Colombia, different president, different situation. But yeah, it's all very interesting.
Yeah, I think, it is incredibly interesting. Well, as we always know, and the listeners know, never dull in Colombia at all. And in your line of work, I imagine even less so. I mean, sometimes I'm referred to as a non-conventional adrenaline junkie, but I think you are more so for this kind of work.
Yeah, we didn't choose an easy life, that's for sure. In the demining world, it's always a challenge working in environments where there's either ongoing conflict or in post-conflict parts of the world. But yeah, Colombia is no exception to that.
Do you refer to Colombia as ongoing conflict?
The official line is we're in a post-conflict environment.
Okay.
However, that's largely due to the 2016 peace deal that was signed between the FARC and the government at the time. The reality is actually quite different. So there's ongoing conflicts mostly between armed groups between themselves, but also between the sort of the state forces, the Colombian government, trying to improve the security conditions across the country. So there is active conflict, and in particular, the areas where there are still landmines in the country, there are, there's still ongoing conflict. So I would probably say we're somewhere in between the two, depending on where you are in the country.
Obviously, I mean, you have official lines that you have to follow. I mean, me and a lot of colleagues, academics and journalists and talk, we call it the post-accord, just because, it just sort of evades problems on that one. But Ollie, let's start with a general overview. Conflicts all over the world, as always. According to the Halo Trust right now, What is the situation regarding sort of landmines and I guess expansion and use of or of course demining?
Yes, so that's a very good question. Landmines are still a massive problem around the world. That can't be denied. There are ongoing conflicts that we're still cleaning up. Ordnance that was dropped during the Vietnam War. And we've started doing work in places like the Solomon Islands, where the munitions that we're dealing with there are from the Second World War. So in terms of the Halo Trust as an organization, we go beyond the landmines. So we do deal with weapons and ammunition management. So regionally speaking, in Latin America, for example, we have projects in Central America, in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, for the destruction of degraded munitions and the improvements to weapon storage to prevent sort of leaking of weapons back onto the black market and those kinds of things, weapons destruction. Similarly, in places like Guinea-Bissau in West Africa. But we still continue with what we would call traditional humanitarian mine action activities across, in total with all of our weapons and ammunition management and demining work, we are working in 30 different countries around the world. Obviously, the level of work and the type of work that we're doing differs greatly and depends very much on the context that we're in. So places in Africa is still sort of a lot of problems with landmines. Obviously, Ukraine is the big one at the moment. So we currently have about 900 staff working for us in Ukraine, which is a considerable expansion since the beginning of the war. We are dealing with all sorts of different ordnance problems. The estimation currently is that it's going to take us about 30 years to clear the dropped ordnance in Ukraine, as well as the landmine problem. Most recently, we've identified over 5,000 anti-vehicle mines in a period of 2 months. So lots and lots of work going on there. Obviously, all the work that we do is centrally focused on the communities, the people that have been affected by conflict. And Halo is taking more of an approach of action on conflict. So it's not just a question of clearing landmines. It's finding out what more we can do for society, making sure that the communities that have been affected by conflict are receiving the highest level of support that we as an organization can provide them. So, as I said, it's an ongoing issue. conflict will always need resolution. And with most modern conflict at the moment, the advances in technology are still ongoing, and we're finding new devices that have either been conventionally made for sort of for war essentially or for military purposes, but also the improvised devices, which is a huge problem. Specifically in Afghanistan, we have a very large component of staff who are dealing with what we call abandoned improvised mines. So after the Taliban takeover, there are still an awful lot of improvised landmines or improvised explosive devices, IEDs, littered across the country. Some of which still have strategic and tactical value, which we obviously can't deal with because we wouldn't want to put our staff at any sort of risk. But there are many of these devices which are still very viable and functioning with a very high mortality rate that have been abandoned. So there are communities that are unable to access farmland. They are unable to sort of graze their animals or allow their children to go to school. And they feel and they are very confined by the presence of explosive devices. So Halo's work essentially is to ensure that we protect the lives and livelihoods of people affected by conflict. Colombia specifically is a very complex scenario. Colombia has more than 12,000 registered landmine victims, and that's been registered since 1990. And the shift, very unfortunately, in more recent years, has gone from military personnel having accidents to the greater majority is now civilians. So this is a big problem. Obviously, there's accidents occurring every single week in Colombia. There are certain areas of the country where that is more so the case. So Nariño in the southwest has the highest accident rates at the moment. Cauca, Valle del Cauca, Antioquia, Norte Santander, Arauca, Meta, Guaviare, all the sort of the regions of the country that are most difficult to access in terms of security and stability is where we are now directing our operations and where we are trying to get into. But the access is for us perhaps the most challenging part. So being able to access areas where armed groups are still very, very active is difficult because we are a neutral organization. We are apolitical, non-religious, and we have no affiliations on either side. Our job and the work that we do is, as you'd say in Spanish, por y para la comunidad. So it's for the community. And it's a very much a humanitarian mission. So yeah, I mean that's essentially where we are at the moment. The conditions for operating are fragile, certainly, and especially in areas where there are armed groups present. There's a lot of distrust, let's say, in any sort of institution, state or non-state. And we work exceptionally hard on our community liaison and understanding of who we are and what we do to ensure that we have the correct access and permissions from the community. Obviously, we're not allowed to, as a civilian organization, we cannot speak directly with the armed group, so we can't proactively communicate with them, which presents a different set of challenges as well. But through community liaison and through the links that we have with our communities, which is very, very strong, and the support we have from the sort of Vereda presidents and all the communities where we work is exceptional. But unfortunately, in certain scenarios where security conditions don't allow us to work, we have to pause our operations and wait for security to kind of calm down a little bit to allow us to deploy our teams safely and not have any risk to our staff.
Wow. There's so much in what you just said there.
sorry.
That's all right, though. But you gave me the full official line and what's going on. But I wanted to ask then, because you say, you know, you're apolitical, of course, perfect. Mm. And the access being difficult. And you mentioned, obviously, you're talking about Colombia, but I wanted to sort of roll back because it's the situation which I'm thinking about is you've got, as you said, some 900 people on the ground in Ukraine. And I see a similar problem here in Colombia because of an ongoing conflict in the departments which you mentioned. But do, for example, Russian belligerent forces come in to Ukraine, they've laid the landmines, you're going out and trying to obviously get rid of them, explode them, demine them, whatever. And they must see you as a hindrance to their... That's what I would see as very difficult. You're in an active conflict zone. This is not like being in the Solomon Islands or demining the Falklands or the Malvinas, depending on where you stand. Where the conflict is over. You're in an active mining zone. Are members of the Halo Trust seen as potential targets? That's my concern.
It's a very interesting point, Richard. We have a lot of protocol, obviously, to allow us to work in areas where there is ongoing conflict. And Halo is I wouldn't say used to it, but we have experience working in environments where there is ongoing conflict. Mm. Ukraine is obviously the most recent one and the most tragic event to have happened to Europe since the Second World War. There are lots of protocols to make sure that our staff are not at danger and are not targeted by Russian forces. Mm. It's things like making sure that we are operating within a very, very healthy distance away from the line of contact. Mm. So normally it's between 20 and 30 kilometers away to make sure that our staff are not essentially in the line of fire. Mm. The line of contact in Ukraine does move. It varies quite a lot. So as the Russian forces are either being pushed back or advance, we adapt where we're actually allowed to work or where we deploy our teams to make sure that there's no crossover there and make sure that nobody is at risk. Currently, we are just identifying items for the Ukrainian government to, and Ukrainian forces to come in and destroy. So we are not actually destroying the items themselves at the moment. We are working towards that. We're very close to doing ordnance disposal. But whilst there's still active conflict, those who are actually responsible for the destruction of those devices are actually the Ukrainian forces. So we're doing a lot of work as well in risk education. There are lots of proposed risks to communities through ordnance that's either been launched or dropped that hasn't actually exploded. So even though it may look fairly inert and safe, the danger is very, very real. A lot of these devices are very fragile. So we're putting in a lot of work, and especially at the beginning of the war when we weren't able to access a lot of these areas, we were doing a lot of remote risk education, a lot of work through Facebook and social media, through radio messaging and through physical printed materials, as well as providing the local people with individual sessions to explain the dangers and what to look out for, how to behave safely in environments where there may be a risk. So it's all part of what we do. But at the moment, we're in a process of identification of where these devices are and a lot of mapping as well and sort of creating a database. So eventually, if the Ukrainian forces are unable to do those destructions, at least we have them mapped and reported. So making sure that the community is as safe as possible.
And have you been out? Have you been sent out?
I haven't been sent out to Ukraine. We have a very capable and very strong and experienced team out there, mostly Ukrainians. The majority of our staff are Ukrainian. We do have an international component, yes, but of the, I believe we're at around 11,000 odd staff at the moment globally, perhaps a bit more now. Of that, we are a few hundred internationals. So we provide the link between our headquarters, which is in Dumfries in Scotland, where we were set up initially in the late 80s. And we provide that link to HQ as the international staff working in the program. So we have a national sort of staff who are heads of programs, but we also have international staff such as myself who also head up programs, and we have different areas of work. So anywhere between sort of donor reporting, monitoring, evaluation, finance, and all the extra sort of bells and whistles. So it's very much a collaborative effort between those affected directly in their home countries by conflict, as well as an international support as well.
So, I mean, yeah, this kind of I mean, it is amazing, isn't it? This is what I like about the Halo Trust, though, is that, you know, one of the key things that I learned and I took away the last time in 2019 is that there's so much training provided for the local communities. And that's
absolutely.
It. I mean, which, you know, it's not sort of like they're not burdened with waiting for the next wave of humanitarian do-gooders, let's say. I mean, I don't want to put it, that sounds negative, but they're not waiting for that. You train up people in those communities with a voice, yeah, and therefore they can then take the projects on.
Absolutely. The big thing for us as well is employment. So currently in Colombia, we have about 400 staff. We are projecting to increase and grow over the next 12 months, hopefully to around 800 staff across the program. We work in communities and parts of the country where formal employment is not that common. Yeah. So as I'm sure you're aware, the informal economy here of sort of growing produce and selling it doesn't come with any of the benefits of formal employment. So all of our staff have healthcare, they have a pension, they have holidays paid for, all of the extra bits that come along with formal employment in parts of the country where that's not common at all. Mm. So we do provide all of our, especially our operations staff, we provide them with medical training so they're able to attend an emergency if needed. We offer driver training, so getting people's driving license so they can drive for us. And we also offer sort of further education as well as part of the package of being employed with Halo. If you want to learn English or a second language, or you want to sort of develop your sort of academic learning, there are funding lines within the organization that allow us to provide further education for our staff. This is really important because the very nature of our work is we clear the landmines and then we leave. There's no reason for us to stay in municipalities which are now landmine free. So to make sure that the staff who are employed with us have the best opportunities for their next step in their career progression, we make sure that they are provided with different types of training as we start coming towards the end of our work in a particular region, to make sure that the staff have, yeah, as I said, the greatest possibility for their next step with their career.
But I think this makes a lot of sense, the social change, because I know that in a lot of places, it's the reintegrated members of the former guerrilla or former FARC who are identifying where the mines are. And a lot of them are involved in the demining access. And so these are people who have been, they haven't had access to these opportunities in life. And so therefore you are now providing something so they don't fall back into an armed group, let's say.
Absolutely. That's hugely important. There's a wonderful organization in Colombia which does humanitarian demining called Humanicemos. Mm-hmm. Humanicemos is made up entirely of former combatants from the FARC, which is a really amazing project. They've run into quite a few difficulties in the past few years, but they seem to be advancing very, very well. And it's a really interesting project. We also do employ former combatants as long as they've come through the right sort of processes with the government. We've actually had scenarios in the past where we've had former combatants clearing minefields that they were actually part of laying. Yeah. So they installed landmines, which they were then responsible for, which was an amazing story and really, really impressive to see. But yes, the reintegration of people who were formerly part of armed groups is a massive part of the process that we're doing in trying to build stability and peace. There are a lot of new projects about to sort of launch, and there are some very serious discussions going on with the JEP, with the HEP. So in terms of looking at options for reformative justice, and potentially, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the TOARS, which is essentially a project through the JEP, which will allow former combatants from armed groups as well as the former military forces to essentially pay their dues to society through humanitarian demining. Mm-hmm. It's still in the very, very early stages, and we're still kind of figuring out how it's actually going to work legally and contractually and all those kinds of different things. But it's really wonderful to see that there is this incentive at a government level to sort of reintegrate a lot of people back into society through the demining work that we do, which is a really wonderful thing to see.
So those could be, you know, some of the, let's say, ex-combatants, former combatants paying their dues. This could be like the sentence handed down once they've gone to the HEP and admitted, and you know they're seen as obviously not having committed, you know, crimes against humanity, because of course that's the big one. But if they're sort of, yeah, let's say low-ranking guerrillas or low ex-combatants, they could be put through a process of doing their sentence in demining.
That is essentially the concept behind it, Richard. I'm not the authority. I'm still doing my investigation, so I don't want to sort of commit to any sort of legal legislation or anything like that to explain how it's actually working. But it's a really, really interesting concept, and it's something which some of our colleagues in the other demining organizations in Colombia are already looking into. There's a lot of interest from the international community as well to support this process, especially in that effort for what we call the triple nexus. So the triple nexus is essentially peace, stability, and humanitarianism. Mm-hmm. So it's allowing these and development, sorry, not stability. So it's creating the conditions to allow for a more stable country. Mm-hmm. Without humanitarian intervention and humanitarian demining, the processes for peace become more challenging. Without humanitarian intervention, the processes for development in rural parts of the country are almost impossible. So that we're all very kind of closely linked, and it's great to see that there's this. There's been a real step up in the change in government in a political will to advance the processes for humanitarian demining and a better understanding of where it sits in terms of that chain of events for allowing rural development and stability to actually kind of take shape.
You mentioned that your staff at the moment is at 400 and you're looking to increase to 800. I'm sure my listeners will be thinking, God, that must mean that things are really bad in Colombia. Perhaps you could explain that to us.
Yeah. So it's not so much that the situation's any worse than it has been in the past. Yes, security conditions right now in Colombia are not improving, I would say, is probably the most positive way of putting it. However, it's more to do with the access to these particular areas. So if we look at places like Norte Santander, for example, where there's a very large presence of the ELN. Mm. So the peace negotiations that are currently going on and the ceasefire that's just been agreed should, in theory, open up more space for us to actually go in and work. There is a push from the components that govern humanitarian demining as part of the Colombian government to take a slightly different view of how they've looked at it in the past. So previously, it's been necessary to have stable security conditions in order for a municipality or a zone of a municipality to be assigned to a demining operator. Mm-hmm. What's happened over the past sort of 10, 12 years or so is the municipalities that have had a landmine issue that are considered to be a bit more stable are now completed. So HALO has managed to hand over more than 25 municipalities as landmine free. So that's the largest statistic for a civilian organization. So there's a very large area of land, but there's still more than 120 municipalities that still haven't been assigned to civilian or any sort of demining operators. So there is a state capacity as well, which is worth mentioning, which is made up of the humanitarian demining brigade of the military. Mm-hmm. And then there's the civilian sector, which there's currently five of us, five operators currently working in the country. So these 120 municipalities, principally in places like Meta, Guaviare, the Pacific coast as well, it has a lot of sort of security problems, which has prevented humanitarian demining operators to actually intervene. Arauca, Norte Santander, a lot of the areas in the borders with Venezuela, as well as the sort of the northern, central northern Andean region. So Cordoba, Antioquia, and sort of that sort of northern part as we're getting closer to the Caribbean coast. So it's not a case that the situation is worse. Yes, unfortunately, landmines are still being used as a tactic by non-state armed groups. They are still being produced. They're still being installed. However, there's still a lot of mines in the ground here that have been there for quite a long time, anywhere between sort of 15 and 3 years. The lethality of the devices in Colombia is actually relatively low. The devices that we find here are all almost exclusively homemade IEDs.
Oh, really?
So essentially it can be made from a plastic bottle or a glass bottle or a tube or a plastic container filled with explosives, and they're essentially artisanally made, which does sort of have a little bit of a question about how long they are viable in the ground for, but it's almost impossible to tell. We are doing studies to look about sort of landmine degradation, and we're working with a couple of universities here to see if we can understand how quickly that degradation process is actually going, to see what types of techniques that we would use for clearance in those particular areas when landmines have been in the ground for a longer period of time. So, you look at where the accidents are actually happening. The likelihood is that those mines have been installed more recently. The likelihood of an accident happening of a mine that was installed 15 years ago is relatively low. However, it's impossible to say until you've actually destroyed the item. So it would be very difficult for us to say to a community, oh, don't worry, they were installed a long time ago. They probably don't work. I wouldn't have the personal confidence to walk through an area which we thought they might not work. It'd be very difficult to convince a community of the same. Go ahead. Sorry.
So I was thinking, you know, you said plastic bottles and so on. Like I can imagine, the push of a syringe, something like that. How do you find those? I mean, because they're not metallic.
Sure. So there's three principal mechanisms that initiate a landmine, the devices that we find in Colombia. So you have chemical, as you've just mentioned. So essentially, you have a syringe with hydrochloric acid that's poking out the top of the ground. You step on the syringe plunger, and that injects the hydrochloric acid into like a starter, initiator. And there's an exothermic reaction, which then creates a sympathetic reaction to the explosive around it, and then it explodes. The second type is electrical. So it requires a battery, anywhere between sort of three or four AA batteries taped together, or you get the bigger, larger sort of batteries, which last more. But obviously, they have a shelf life. If you have a battery buried in the ground in Colombia, which is a very rainy place, there's a lot of precipitation, that battery is only going to last so long. We have actually found situations in certain parts of the country that we know when we start finding batteries with a metal detector, there's probably a landmine nearby because armed groups would come in and change the batteries. The third type is mechanically initiated. So this can be very, very rudimentary, anywhere from a basic tripwire attached to the pin of a grenade, and that will pop out and then the grenade will explode. Or there's a very common type of mine in that we find in Meta called a betún. So betún is the brand of Colombian shoe polish. So it essentially looks like about the size of a shoe polish can with a spring-loaded mechanism on top that holds two firing pins. So as soon as you step on it, the firing pins shoot out and ignite the sort of homemade explosives, pentolite or ampho, again, and then they go up. So on the whole, what we tend to find, with exceptions, are relatively small devices around about the size of a bottle. These devices are not designed to kill. They're designed to injure and maim. So the concept is if you're an armed group and you've protected your camp or a trade route, or even nowadays they're being used to protect illicit crops, which is a very challenging scenario as well. If someone steps on a military force steps on a landmine and they lose a foot or a toe or the lower extremity, or if they're looking downwards, it can blind you. It's quite a common injury. That requires two people to pull that person out. So automatically, you've managed to disable three people from a battle just with one very small, cheap, easy-to-make device. So the way in which we find that the landmines here in Colombia is I'll just run you through the very basic process. So that the first, once we've been granted permission to work through, work in a Vereda, we will interview the local community and essentially find the contextual information that will allow us to identify a minefield. Mm-hmm. So if there have been landmine accidents, if animals have been killed by mines, if they've seen wires poking out of the ground or syringe tops, if there have been warnings from armed groups that there are mines in the area, this is all evidence that we gather to allow us to essentially plot out a minefield. And we use that, we use sort of very basic mapping tools and GPS units to plot out where we believe there is a minefield. Once that's done, we will then send in the second stage, which is the manual deminers. So mm-hmm. in other parts of the world, you may have seen sort of big machines kind of trolling through desert and picking up landmines through loaders and rakes and all these kinds of different things, which is a wonderful, very fast technique. But that's not really possible in Colombia because everything is like this. So it's a very, very steep, mountainous country, and getting machines up there is almost impossible. So the only way that we can really most effectively clear landmines is with a human being with a metal detector. So essentially what we do, there's the most fundamental technique is called one person, one lane. Mm-hmm. So you have a meter wide lane, essentially, and they will go centimeter by centimeter sweeping a metal detector to see if there are any metal signals in the ground. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of landmines do have some level of metal content. So normally the detonator, which are sort of factory made for mining and they're fairly common and fairly easy to get hold of, is your starting point. So that has a metal casing around it, which our detectors can pick up. Obviously, if we're sweeping for metal in a field or in a forest or wherever we might be, there's contamination in the ground. So it could be coins, metal, bits of wire, bottle caps, you name it, anything that's made of metal, we have to investigate it as if it were a landmine. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the time is taken up from our deminers investigating signals which turn out to be nothing. Mm-hmm. But we have to be very, very cautious and make sure that every single is investigated and treated very delicately as if it were an explosive device. So once we've identified, let's say we have our deminer in his or her lane, and they find a metal signal and they investigate that signal and it turns out to be a landmine. As I've mentioned, most of the devices here are almost exclusively all the devices here are homemade, which means that they're made of relatively brittle components. So we're talking about plastic and glass. So what we can do in order to remove that device is we set up what's called a disruptor, which is essentially a metal tube about 30, 40 centimeters long, filled with water with a tiny hole in the end. And it has a black powder charge at one end. And we set up our metal tube, our disruptor, pointing at the device. We then go back the safety distance, which is 100 meters, and pass an electrical current through the black powder, which essentially shoots the jet of water at that device, and it breaks it apart. So when that happens, what's called the explosive chain is disrupted. So it means that the components of that device are now safe to handle. So we take all of those components out of the minefield and make sure that they're completely safe to handle. So the process is very, very safe in neutralizing that device. And then we burn those components so they can be never can be used again to build a landmine. The problem comes in when we start finding things like mortars or grenades, which have a metal skin. We are allowed in Colombia, well, we're not allowed in Colombia to use explosives as a civilian organization. So if we were to find, I don't know, mortars, airdrop bombs, grenades, you name it, in somewhere like Afghanistan, what we would do is we would do a mass destruction in a very large pit with a shape charge, so an our own explosive, then that kind of explodes the other things and off they go. We're not allowed to do that in Colombia. As civilian civilian organization, we cannot handle or store explosives. So the solution we have has actually come through a technology which was developed in New Zealand. So we received funding from the New Zealand government, and they've been one of our most stable donors for the past 5 years. And they developed a technology called thermite burning devices. Essentially, it looks like a baked bean can or a sort of like a, I don't know, can I use baked bean can in Colombia?
Yeah,
sort
of frijoles, like, let's say.
Frijoles, yeah, kind of frijoles. It's filled with an aluminothermic powder. Basically, what that does, when we do the same process and pass a metal charge, an electrical charge through it, it converts that aluminothermic powder into what essentially looks like lava. And then what happens is that very, very hot metal will burn through the skin of a metal device. So it could be a grenade or a mortar or even an airdrop bomb. And then what it does is it burns the explosive out inside the device, in theory, without making it explode. We always have to plan that it will explode, but the theory is that the explosives are burned out and then it's rendered safe to move.
God, I mean, listening to all this, it's fascinating, but it makes me feel so uncomfortable. that's the truth. I don't know if you can say, but, you know, there's a couple of questions I have burning holes in my head. Who are the principal actors in Colombia using landmines then?
So, as I've mentioned, the landmines have been used in the country since about late 80s, early 90s, and they continue to be used today. So the largest armed groups that have been operational in Colombia are obviously the FARC EP and the ELN. Mm-hmm. There are multiple sort of other smaller armed groups, the paramilitaries. You have the more criminally organized groups like the Clan del Golfo. The more criminal sort of organized crime side of things, it's not that common to use landmines, and same with the paramilitaries. It's not a common mechanism, so it's mostly through sort of the armed groups that have been most prevalent in the country and had the widest spread, which have been the FARC EP and the ELN. There have been some more recent tactics as well, as I mentioned, in installing landmines around illicit crops, particularly coca, to prevent forced eradication. It's a more recent tactic that we have started to see of people who are involved in the production of coca using landmines to protect their crops. Mm-hmm. They're protecting their crops against forced eradication. This brings in a multitude of problems, not only for the presence of the devices themselves, but our work as a humanitarian organization working in areas where there are illicit crops. So we have to be very careful in maintaining our neutrality and the image within the community that the presence of a humanitarian demining organization does not mean that forced eradication will then necessarily happen. But as I said, it's there have been accidents with eradicators. They are relatively low. It is used as a deterrent. Obviously, those types of landmines are very, very difficult for us to deal with and almost impossible because they present or represent a strategic or tactical value. Mm-hmm. We cannot go in and remove items that are still valuable to an armed group or any sort of criminal organization. Because it would put our staff at risk. And as you were mentioning in Ukraine, it could potentially put a target onto us as an organization from some nasty people.
So we have to wind this down, and you've got very important work to do. Have you ever had a close call?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Fortunately, no. I can say that with all the confidence in the world. The work that we do is exceptionally safe. Okay. Yes, accidents do happen. We have had a number of accidents across the world. Fortunately, in Colombia, we haven't had any landmine accidents as an organization. There are a lot of protocols. There's a lot of standard procedures. There's a lot of monitoring, quality control. Every area that we clear is controlled and monitored internally and externally. Mm-hmm. So the OAS are responsible for the external monitoring of all landmine clearance activities across the board. Okay. So that's with the military and the civilian sector. So there's also the protective gear that we use to work whilst we're clearing landmines, and the equipment that we use to detect them is very, very functional and very, very safe. So personally, I've never had a close call, and I'm unaware of any sort of major close calls that we as an organization have had in Colombia. The majority of accidents that do occur tend to be if there's something like a degraded device that should be safe to handle, and for some reason something goes wrong, or the device is more volatile than we've anticipated. And unfortunately, we have had some deaths in the organization, but it's very rare. Considering the amount of ordnance that we find and destroy, in Zimbabwe, for example, we are finding thousands and thousands of mines every single month. And all the munitions in Afghanistan are in the tons of this. In every month, we destroy tons and tons and tons of ordnance. So, yes, fortunately, no close calls for me. I have been fortunate to travel to places like Afghanistan and Somalia and Kosovo. But so far, touch woods, and I'd prefer to keep it that way, that no close calls. Thank you very much.
Well, I think hopefully if your parents, family, fiancé are listening, they will feel more at ease about this. Ollie, thank you so much for such an interesting and informed conversation about something. It's so important, and keep up the good work, and please stay safe.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Richard. Well, as I said, it's a real pleasure for us to actually be working in Colombia, and it's phenomenal work that the teams do in the field, and I have so much respect for everything that RD Miners do. It's really tough, hands and knees in the heat, in the jungle, in exposed to the sun, and it's always done with a big smile on their face, and it's for the community, and allowing people to create safe conditions for the communities that they're from is the most gratifying thing that we can possibly do. So long may it continue. Hopefully it doesn't continue too much longer. We actually resolve the problem, but that the goal is to work ourselves out of a job. But hopefully, we'll start seeing some more progress and access into these more tricky areas in the country. But anytime, Richard, if you've got any questions from your listeners, I'd be more than happy to get in touch.
I've forgotten one thing. How many municipalities are affected in Colombia?
That's a very good question.
You don't have it.
I don't have that. So, I think almost all departments in the country at some stage have had some level of contamination. Obviously, the lower parts of the country, where the in the non-mountainous regions, less so. So Amazonas, for example, not so much. But I think I'm fairly confident in saying that almost all departments have had some level of contamination. But there's still, as I've said, there's still 120 municipalities that haven't had any intervention yet. So we're working very closely with the government and the other demining operators to make sure that we start getting into those places and providing the support to the communities that need it most.
Okay. Sorry to spring that on you at the end. It was just on my list of things. Ollie, thank you so much. And as I said, stay safe. Everyone, check out the Halo Trust, the website. If you're flush for cash, donate something as well, because they're doing some really incredible and important work. Ollie, thank you so much. It has been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Not at all. Thank you very much, Richard. Right.
Bye-bye, everyone. The Colombia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Colombia Calling website, that's www.colombiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian Adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.